Oh, thank you. It was very, very happy to be back. Thank you very much for having me back. Also, pointer. I'm in Canada. Although your shirt reminds me that it takes a while to you vote today.
I hope you already went to the.
Oh, of course. I sent my ballot in last week. So, okay, so I'll be talking about supersymmetry breaking gauge mediation at theory gut models. This is work done with some folks back at Caltech, Natalia Salinas, who are shaped with Namecki, and also a group of paper collaboration with a group at Harvard, including John Heckman and Kuhafa. So let me just begin. The LHC is here. Well, okay, it's not here yet. It's almost here. I actually put this slide together just before the latest bit of technical difficulties in September. So I gave this talk the week after that happened. So having to tell everybody, okay, it's almost here. But, you know, if we pumped in a financial bailout worth of money, maybe we could hurry things along. Anyway, so the LHC era has finally arrived. And we hope to learn lots of things, lots of new physics. You know, maybe we'll learn about what explains the hierarchy. I put if anything because, you know, some people like the anthropic principle. And I guess it's a question of whether you're explaining the hierarchy in that case or not. But okay, what comprises dark matter? And I guess there's also exciting direct detection searches going on now also. But the LHC might help us with that. Will grand unification be an idea that survives? Or is it going to, you know, be thrown into the waste bin of really great coincidences that just didn't pan out? But, you know, at the end of the day, all this exciting stuff is going on. And, you know, can we get involved? As string theorists, you know, what can we hope to learn from the LHC? It's a good question. So the LHC is primarily teaching us about particle physics. In string theory, a lot of times, not all models, but, you know, in type 2 models, we could engineer particles or gauge groups using D-brain. Engineer charged particles with open strings. And that's quite nice because D-brains like to wrap certain cycles in the compactification, and the open strings are really, you know, in some sense tied to them. You know, the open strings can probe, you know, other, you know, away from the stack of brains in a geometry, but there's a significant energy cost associated with that. So at low energies, the open strings are only going to explore relatively nearby regions in the geometry. So in some sense, the LHC is providing data not about the full compactification, but it's providing us data about this, you know, sort of little neighborhood. In some sense, you can even think about it as encoding geometric information about this neighborhood. And understanding that kind of dictionary would, of course, be something that's very nice, although this is just philosophizing, so you know, take it with a grain of salt. So the point is that this kind of thinking motivates the local approach, which is not a new one. It's been advocated before, going back to this paper was in 2000 or 2001. And the most recent proponents of this have been Berlinde and Reinhold. And it was from Berlinde that I learned about this kind of thing from some nice Tali lectures. One can try to adopt a bottom-up approach where focus on local model building, namely local models that are supposed to capture the geometry in this region near the brains. And you can ask how much you can do in that context, and then seek to, you know, if you have some promising results there, seek to build a full compactification sort of from the ground up. Or alternatively, a local model like this can give you a lamppost. If you find some successful frameworks in local models, it might tell you, you know, promising areas or regions of the landscape to start exploring for good particle physics. One thing to emphasize, I didn't write it in the slide, but I've been repeatedly emphasizing this, is that local models, you know, really are giving us a class of effective field theories. They all come with a cutoff scale that's associated with, you know, sort of the size of this region. And a number of coupling constants, basically, things that tell us about how this region is glued into the compact geometry. So any local model taken within itself, taken by itself, is nothing other, of course, than a string-motivated effective field theory. But you can get nice classes of string-motivated effective field theories and hope to see patterns emerging. You know, what kinds of scenarios are easy to get, what kinds of scenarios are difficult to get. And sometimes the string model will give you some nice stringy physics, which explains things like small parameters and so on, which from a purely effective field theory point of view might appear to be tuned. So we can try to incorporate all this by building local models. And I think I said all of this. Please.
Should I just think of this as a subset of all string theories? Or is this sort of a duality frame that makes, you know, certain aspects of the physics simple and localizes it?
Sure. I would say that I wouldn't want to say that. I would say that you're trying to describe a subset of string compactifications, but it's not a priori obvious that you're describing an honest subset of all viable string compactifications, because it's not immediately obvious that any local construction you build here can be put into a compact model. It's also not. I don't think it's true that this sort of bottom up approach is one that's obvious in all duality frames in string theory. But for type 2 model building, it's something that makes sense. Does that answer your question? Okay. So the LHC is makes it a particularly exciting time for trying to do string phenomenology kind of issues, largely because it, you know, the promise of low-energy supersymmetry. If we're lucky and if the LHC actually sees low-energy supersymmetry, it'll hand us, well, maybe not realistically won't hand us a supersymmetric Lagrangian, but, you know, it'll hand us some clues towards what a supersymmetric Lagrangian, you know, what supersymmetric Lagrangian we should be aiming for. And that can serve as a nice bridge connecting, you know, particle physics to string theories for the simple fact that supersymmetric models are typically easier to engineer and control in string theory. So that's why, you know, you might have asked why wouldn't we be able to do, you know, a stringy motivated or string phenomenology based on local models even before the LHC era? What's special about the LHC? Well, I think this is really one of the things that makes the LHC era particularly exciting. And then I just remind why we expect low energy SUSY. Well, can address the hierarchy problem while providing a dark matter candidate. There's the usual picture of unification. And if one is completely optimistic, and I'll admit this is being very optimistic, but if one is completely optimistic, one might hope to find a supersymmetric gut with some low-scale SUSY breaking. So preserve this nice, you know, this nice coincidence of unification, have low-energy supersymmetry and everything. It's a very optimistic scenario, but, you know, it's not that there's, you know, it's not particularly lacking in evidence. There's certainly some evidence for it. So that's a particularly optimistic scenario, and we'll proceed with under this assumption throughout what we're doing, because before the LHC turns on, you have to start somewhere. So an even more optimistic scenario for local models is gauge mediation, and that's because, you know, local models involve a decoupling of gravity. So if you can describe supersymmetry breaking and its mediation all within the same local framework, then that's pretty exciting. So that's another problem. So, but there are lots of obstacles to building supersymmetric guts in string theory using D-brains and type 2. Exceptional gauge groups are tough to get because, well, engineering exceptional gauge bosons is kind of a chore. We don't really know how to do it in perturbative framework with using D-brains. SO10 guts are difficult because we don't know how to engineer the spinner 16 using perturbative D-brains. SU5 guts, you can make progress, that's for sure. But this D-brain realization in perturbative type 2 gives you an extra gauge U1. Instead of an SU5, you get U5. And this extra U1 forbids the 10-10-5 U-color coupling. And that's kind of important because in the 10-10-5 U-color coupling, conventional SU5 is what gives you the top quark mass. So this is actually something you want to be much larger than the other ones, not necessarily smaller. Although you can get around that by going to a flipped SU5 model. People have engineered flipped SU5 models, but this is getting to the bottom quark mass. So it's known that this can be generated non-perturbatively in type 2B using, say, well, in type 2 models, there are type 2A SU5 guts that generate this thing using D2 instantons. However, to the mere fact that you start needing to use non-perturbative effects to generate this suggests, at least to me, that a non-perturbative formulation is probably better suited to the task. So you can overcome a lot of these problems using techniques of geometric engineering in one of the two non-perturbative frameworks for type 2. The first involves M-theory on G2 manifolds. It's difficult to build local models of the visible sector here because, well, we don't know that much about G2 manifolds. But nevertheless, a lot of progress has been made nearby, actually, a lot of this done in Michigan by various there are a lot of papers by linear combinations of these authors, and I think I have all of them. Hope I'm not missing anyone. Where they study, they show that even if you aren't able to engineer the visible framework, you can put together some nice gravity-mediated scenario just based on generic properties of the moduli potential in G2 manifolds. But the other option is F-theory on Clabial fourfolds. We know a lot more about Clabial fourfolds. They have holomorphy, and so there are lots of powerful techniques for determining the spectrum and couplings. And it's particularly exciting. It was developed earlier this year, the appearance of two papers back in February by Donaghi and Weinhold and then Beasley, Heckman, and Vaffa. And I should emphasize, BHV really went a long way to actually even determining the couplings and the action that one gets from this jump. So now, get to outline. So the plan is very simple. We'll talk about reviewing some basic tools of constructing F-theory guts. I guess there was a talk earlier this year about this, so I will try not to belabor it too much. Then I'll talk about two important additional subjects. One is the ability to generate new scales. Any supersymmetric gut needs lots of new dimensional parameters, well, at least three. And we'll talk about how to get these things using instantons in F-theory guts. And then this will lead us to some issue here is going to lead us to some scenario for gauge-mediated SUSY breaking that has some nice features. And so I hope to talk about that. Question? OK, good. So what is F-theory? It's a framework for studying type 2B compactifications with an aberrant axial dilaton. It's particularly nice because it can be used to describe collections of mutually non-perturbative type 2-7 brains. What I mean by that is, you know, 1-0 strings can end on D7 brains, but you can have other 7 brains on which BQ strings can end. And if you have many of these guys with non-commuting monodromies floating around, then there's no global perturbative framework because the degrees of freedom associated with different brains are, well, not mutually perturbative. So in F theory, one interprets this tau as the modulus of some elliptic fiber. So you imagine having your threefold here and some sort of torus over the base. And this fiber degenerates at various points. A degeneration signals the blowing up of singularity in tau, which signals the presence of a seven brain. So the loci where the fiber degenerates are basically the locations of the seven brains. So this is a cartoon I drew of two different types of fiber degenerations, although actually they look really the same. But I don't know how to draw different degenerations. So the monodromies of tau actually determine the types of seven brain. The monodromy of tau around the fiber, also the monodromy matrix acts on these charge vectors P and Q, and the type of strings that can end in that seven brain are the ones that are preserved, that are ones that are left invariant by that monotony. So really the geometric structure determines the kind of seven brains. So geometric engineering and F theory, I hope I'm not enough. So the fiber degenerations can be described locally by ADE singularities, and this singularity type is determining the gauge group on the brain. So an example is SUN at this nice simple singularity. Describes ND7 brain as equal zero. So this x squared plus y squared equals constant is roughly giving a local description of this fiber region. And z is sort of a normal direction to the singularity. So the singularity is in dimension 8. And then there's a complex normal direction, which is 2. And then there's the two directions up here, which is the other two in F theory. So when usually described, this is sort of like this z equals zero is like the world volume of ND7 brains. And you can get a reason, get an idea for why it's ND7 brains. This thing comes from piling up n copies of the I1 singularity, which isn't really singular. Of course, each one of these has the same monodromy, so you have a stack of n objects with the same monodromy, so that gives you n identical brains in ND7. So if you want to engineer matter, so you can use seven brains to engineer a gauge group. If you want to engineer matter, the thing to do is to intersect a couple of seven brains. If you take one stack of D7 brains and take one and just rotate it off, then you get bifundamental matter localized at the intersection. So that's a useful way to engineer chiral matter. Geometrically, this corresponds to deforming the singularity. It's very nice. The deformation parameters are in one-to-one correspondence with expectation values of some adjoint field. So when you deform the geometry by turning on one of these ADE deformations, it's basically the same as giving an expectation value to an adjoint, spatially varying expectation value to an adjoint scalar field, which is precisely what does this kind of rotation. So this non-zero T rotates a D7 brain away from the others, and you get bifundamental matter here. And what do we mean by bifundamental matter? Well, that just follows from group theory. You just decompose the adjoint of SUN. Now, SUN minus 1 cross U1, what you're left with is describing the bifundamental matter here. And this, in the simple case of, say, SUN down to SUN minus 1, this is the example we're familiar with of just taking ND7 brains and just taking one of the n and just rotating it. Now, at the end of the day, you actually want to know how many charged matter fields you have living at this intersection. And that's actually determined by counting some zero modes. So it's determined by a bundle cohomology on the intersection surface. Just to make sure I emphasize everything, these seven brains are wrapping four cycles in a three-dimensional base. And they're intersecting on a two cycle, which is a Riemann surface. We often call that Riemann surface a sigma. OK. This is just another simple example of how you get an important multiplicator gut, which is a 10. The group theory, which is very simple, is the adjoint of SO10 when you break to SU5 by giving an expectation value to some adjoint scalar field. The matter you're left over with is a 10 and a 10 bar. So when you take a SO10 singular point and you rotate one of these guys off, the bifundamental matter here is a 10. Now, often one draws these cartoons. We're going to use one big stack of seven brains to build a gut gauge group. And so often we'll draw a cartoon, which is a bubble, which is supposed to represent the world volume of these brains. And then draw a curve here, which is representing the intersection point where it's meeting some matter brain, which has been rotated off to give charged matter. So in this picture, this big S here is is a cartoon for some four cycle in the compact geometry. And this matter curve is some two cycle along which some Riemann surface along which charged matter is localized. You should really think of this as a matter brain, which is actually coming in and hitting the whole thing along this curve. But we don't really draw it. So we don't really draw this thing. We draw this because otherwise it gets too complicated. Yeah, please. That's correct. In this example, the type equation. As you get to higher singularities, I'm not going to remember them. But for this one, it's something like y minus t to the fifth over z plus, and if I'm making a mistake, I'm sure Freddie can correct me, because something like this. So this gives you, at z plus t equals 0, you have an SU5 singularity, or A4, but actually, if I'm lazy, I write the gauge groups. But away from that, sorry, you have, this is totally wrong. At t equals 0, you have an SU10 singularity. And then at z plus t, generically, you have SU5 singularity everywhere at z plus t equals 0. And then when t equals 0, you have an enhancement to SO10. I should probably shift the variable to z within this much. But I mean, this is just, you know, there's a general expression here where you can deform the SO10 to the d5 singularity x squared plus y squared z plus z to the fifth. And you can deform this with several deformation parameters, pi, and these are the one-to-one correspondence with Cartan generators. And this is by memory the one that breaks SO10 to SU5. Did I remember incorrectly? Good. So you have an SU5 singularity everywhere in the bulk. So everywhere in the bulk here, it's basically, so z plus t equals 0 is sort of defining the surface of where you're here at the base of the cone. And then there's a particular regime here where also t is equal to 0. That's this curve here. Sorry.
You get a chiral tend this way?
Sorry?
You get a chiral tend this way?
So the precise matter content you get actually depends on some additional details, which I'll talk about in a bit. You can get a chiral, you can get a 10 or a 10 bar, and the number of 10s or 10 bars depends on, we turn on various gauge fluxes. So one will turn on various gauge flux on the bulk, on the gut brains, and also on the matter brain. By tuning these fluxes, you can get either a 10 or a 10 bar. Or depending on whether this is a P1 or maybe a torus, you can get a 10 and a 10 bar. So it's actually quite versatile. Okay. So spectrum and superpotential couplings are determined by studying seven-brain world volume theory, which itself is fixed by supersymmetry. And the spectrum can, in general, include both adjoint and bifundamental modes. And by adjoint, I just mean modes that live on the gut stack of seven brains. And by bifundamentals, I mean the guys which are localized to these matter curves, which we think of as, you know, basically, roughly speaking, as modes connecting this gut stack to some matter brain that's coming in at intersection. So one can count the numbers of these modes. So in model building, one typically puts a world volume flux on this S, and also on these various matter brains. And the number of zero modes living on here is determined by some unlocal modes. I could actually write these formulas. If you have some bifundamental representation R, which is engineered here, the number in the R is given by H0 of sigma, k sigma half times VR, and the number in the R bar is given by H0 of sigma, k sigma half, also times VR, and VR bar. And I can just tell you what these are. This is just the spin bundle on this surface. It's because you engineer chiral fermions, which have to transform the sections of sections of the spin bundle on the surface, and the bosons get twisted to match that. And this is just the gauge bundle associated with this representation, the appropriate power gauge bundle associated with the bifundamental representation R. So these are just some sort of simple things that you can compute by adjusting what these VRs are. This VR gets a contribution from gauge field on bulk of seven brain and gauge field on matter brain. By doing that, you can sort of adjust how many R's or R bars you get. So this is freedom. Okay, so there's two different kinds of couplings. One is this adjoint bifundamental, which is a clear way to make a gauge invariant. And the other type of coupling comes when three of these Riemann surfaces where matter is localized to intersect. And that's bifundamental. And we'll come to that one later. Okay. So here's an example of a coupling from a triple intersection of matter of the second type. It comes where you have an SU7 singularity here, which is a meeting point of two SU6 singular matter curves. I drew over here what this is really describing. It's really just you have a stack of say D7 brains, and then two matter brains also intersecting. So this curve of intersection here is just one of these guys. This curve of intersection here is just one of these guys. And then in this case, the two matter brains themselves intersect along a third curve. So along one of these guys, you can engineer, say, a 5, it's a five fundamental between 5d7 brains and 1d7 brains. Along another one of these guys, you get a 5 bar, and along this guy, you get something that, from the point of view of the 5d7 brains, is a singlet. And the coupling you get from this is a 5-5-bar-1. And this is something that can be understood even in perturbative 5-2b language. It's a disk amplitude, which generates this coupling, 5-5-bar-1. One I want to make with this slide is you can actually read all this off from group theory. You can imagine starting with SU7 gauge theory on the whole thing, and then turning on expectation values of adjoint scalar field, which break to SU5 almost everywhere. SU6 only along these points, and keep SU7 only at the singular point. And if you follow through with that, you know, basically what this does is it, you know, this expectation value is just sort of going through this breaking procedure. And you can read off the three different kinds of bifundamental matter that can be engineered on matter curves which intersect at this point. And each one of these bifundamental matters corresponds to a different, you know, order of breaking from SU7 to SU5, SU7 to SU6 to SU5, and so on. If I, for instance, start at this point and go out along here, I broke, pick one breaking pattern, SU7 to SU6, and then I go along here, that breaks to SU5, and that second breaking determines the matter localized here. But if I go off here, I've now picked a different way of breaking SU7 to SU6. And so this is a different one. And these represent those two different breaking patterns, and then the singlets come along. So I just want to try to emphasize there's a real connection here. This is very beautiful between geometry and group theory, where you can write down all these deformed geometries, and actually for this case it's much simpler. It's just AN geometries, but in fact there it is. But you can read everything off, everything that you need off of group theory. The other important point I want to make is that we're keeping track of these U1 charges, and that's important because, and that's why I like this picture, these matter brains, when you think of these matter curves that are coming from intersection of some brain objects, it makes clear that each of these matter brains has its own U1 gauge group associated to it. So strictly speaking, in the string constructions, the full gauge group is not SU5 here, it's SU5 cross U1 cross U1, and so these guys are actually charged under some extra U1 gauge group, and here are the charges. Any coupling that you get has to, of course, be gauge invariant. Now, at the end of the day, these U1s will typically be anomalous, they'll lift by Green Schwarz mechanism and so on, but the constraint of some of the constraint of gauge invariances is an important one, at least if there's constructed. So just two other quick examples of the other types of things that one needs for model building. If you look at a singular point that comes from double enhancement from SU5 to SU12, now here's just a group theory. I don't write the geometry because it's much more complicated. This corresponds to a meeting of a 10 matter curve into 5 matter curves, and you can get the 10 5 bar 5 bar Euclidean couple, which is important. And then if you have a double enhancement to E6, here it is, you know, you get a coupling of the form 10 10 5. And so you see these two guys, which appear on such a different footing in type 2 models, from the F theory point of view, appear quite the same way. And the fact that this really has no good type 2 analog is manifesting itself in the fact that it's associated with one of these exceptional singularities that we don't understand in type 2. So one can use all these tools to engineer Susie Gutz and F theory, and that's what Beasley, Heckman, and Vaffa did. They have some very nice models they came out with earlier this year. You take the gut brains, and they pick the gut brains to wrap a Del Pezzo surface, and they have some argument for why it should wrap a Del Pezzo surface, but let me not go into that. Let me just say it wraps a Del Pezzo surface, and Del Pezzo surfaces are nice because they're simple. We know a lot about them, and we can compute all these bundle homologies relevant for actually counting zero modes on them. One can turn on world volume fluxes on the various brains, the gut stack, and the matter brains to remove all exotic matter, provided that the gauge group is basically SU5. So one of the results is that you pick out SU5. If you have higher gauge groups, you get too many exotics. You can't lift them in this nice way. One of the properties is you get no adjoints. They engineer all of their matter from matter curves. And this also seems to be something that's difficult to avoid. And just to remind you what one aims for in SU5 guts, here's the, you know, SU5 gut matter contents of the MSSM. You know, the Q, U, and E go into a 10, the B into a 5 bar, just as a reminder. And you'll notice we scratched out the Higgs triplets because we don't want these to be present. We want to get rid of them somehow. And when I say we get rid of all exotic matter with world volume fluxes, I'm including these guys as being gotten rid of. And the superpotential one needs is just 10, 10, 5, and 10, 5 bar, 5 bar. That should really be a 5 bar. And on the previous slide, we showed how you can get both of these in the context of these guys. So the kind of cartoons they wrote down were things like this, where you have matter curves all over the place and intersecting each other, and then you arrange for fluxes, the numbers of zero modes and various matter curves are correct. But in the end of the day, you're able to get an exotic free model, exotic free local model that has just all the matter content that you want. And that's already nice, you know, some nice progress. And I also think that, yeah. All the moduli are not stabilized in these local models. There are lots of moduli as values that you're basically taking as an input parameter. In particular, each one of these matter brains, each one of these matter curves, for example. Well, actually, let me take even more elementary example. There's this 4-cycle that the gut brains are at. This 4-cycle is what's setting the size of this 4-cycle is what's setting the gut state. This is not the stabilization of this modulus is not something that's addressed in this local frame. So it's actually the coupling constant, the gut scale, which basically determines this volume, is in fact something that's usually taken as an input. But on top of that, even these matter brains, they rack 4 cycles of varying sizes. These things, you know, in a compact model, some of these sizes will not all be independent. Some of them will have relations, will be related. And that's actually interesting to look at, and we're trying to look at this at the moment. But moduli stabilization is not an issue that is ever addressed in these local models. So I stress again, what you're getting from these local models is really an effective field theory with a cutoff scale and coupling constants.
And so no exotic matter means no charged exotic matter.
No exotic matter means no charged exotic matter.
Yes. Okay.
Are some of those moduli, I mean, in your breaking, there were singlets under everything. Are those the moduli you're
I'm sorry. Yeah, the singlets in this breaking,
either one of those. Was
in yeah, let me go to here. These are charged fields we've used for us before, but you're referring to these guys.
Yeah.
These are the U1 gauge bosons. So all these U1s are actually they're gauge symmetries, but they're anomalous, and so we expect they get lifted by Green-Schwarz mechanisms. But again, that's something that one has to go beyond local modeling. So again, yeah.
But are the moduli somehow in a multiplet with those fields, or are they somewhere else in the?
I think they're somewhere else.
Okay.
My understanding.
Are we talking about? Are we talking about the closed loop moduli or open loop moduli? I mean, there seems to have to be some open loop moduli.
Pardon?
Are there open loop moduli?
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
I think we're talking about
line bundles, then no. Line bundles don't have moduli.
So the moduli are the closed loop moduli?
Yes, yeah. The moduli I'm talking about are the closed loop
moduli.
And one of the, I just stress again. One's always studying these models in the limit where basically closed string effects are, roughly speaking, decoupled. Roughly. They don't make any strong. So just one more very quick word about this stuff. And that's how we do double and triplet splitting, because this is important for a point that will come up later. This is, you know, how does one break the gut group from SU5 down to SU3 plus SU2 plus SU1? And what these authors suggest is to turn on a hypercharge, or turn on a non-trivial flux and hypercharge direction, internal direction. There's a requirement that the hypercharge gauge boson remains massless, and this gives you a topological constraint in the compactification. So that's one actual key input from the compactification, and this is actually a sort of a stumbling point for us right now in trying to build compact models, although we're just being silly at the moment, I think. Sure, it'll be overcome. But the point is that this non-trivial hypercharge flux, it affects particle content through the restriction of Ly to various matter curves. So all these charged particles or all these charged fields, they're localized on Riemann surfaces. And the restriction of this gauge bundle, if it restricts non-trivially to a Riemann surface, then it'll affect how you count the number of modes. So for the usual, and here's just some quick formulae for this, you know, for the usual gut multiplets, you know, like the 5-bar, for example, if you want to keep the whole gut multiplet, and if, you know, when you break the SU5 down to standard model, the 5-bar breaks into two pieces with different hypercharge, and you want to keep them both. That means you want the counting for each of them to be the same. So basically, in order to accomplish that, you need this hypercharge bundle, which distinguishes between these two different parts of the 5-bar matter multiplet to restrict trivially to its matter curve. However, for the Higgs, you want to separate the triplets and doublets. You want to count the doublets and triplets differently. And by choosing this hypercharge bundle to restrict non-trivially to the Riemann surfaces for the Higgs fields are localized, you can do that. You can make that distinction and count them differently, and it actually shows that it's quite easy to engineer an example where you have doublet Higgs's but no triplet Higgs's at all. It's, now I won't say anything, if people have more questions about double triplet splitting, I'll say whatever.
I hate to do, can we go one transparency back?
Of course.
So this picture, I just want to understand, so,
yes,
so this is still a local model, but
it's still
do they write down a fourfold, a local fourfold where we have all the right singularities with all the right, or the idea is that, okay, So I can sort of locally engineer each of the singularities separately, like wherever you have, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4 intersections here. But I cannot stick them all.
I'll tell you exactly. They specify the homework. So they pick a 4-cycle, which is compact.
Yeah.
It follows you this 4-cycle. That's already something that's tough, you know, and are able to count on this compact 4-cycle. That's already something that's tough to do with n-cycles. And then they specify the homology classes of these various curves that are needed to get the right intersection numbers and the right bundle restrictions, hypercharge bundle, this is the whole thing, right bundle restrictions to get the counting measure. Do they actually write an equation and actually put coordinates on the del Pezzo and write it, and they write equation for elliptic fiber? No, they don't do this.
But we know it's possible.
I think
once they specify it.
Yeah, I'd be very, very, very surprised if it weren't possible. But in order to fit all this stuff in, they need to go to things like del Pezzo 8, and then it just becomes a bit of a chore, at least my understanding. The low del Pezzos, I think I feel more comfortable with, but when you go to higher del Pezzos, then you have to cover with so many patches. It's a mess.
Can I ask much more basic questions?
Please.
Is the aim is to gain some effective field theory description of the MSSM?
Sorry?
Is the aim of that is to get some effective description that as the supersymmetric standard model, and in particular as some UV completion in string theory, or the aim is to do some non-protoperative calculation?
Good. The aim at the moment is basically to try to see how close we can get to the MSSM in string theory, and along the lines of doing so, do you find any interesting restrictions or patterns, things like this coming up? Mm-hmm.
So it just gives some restriction for the coefficients in some any gap model.
Yeah. Well, the first question I had, because I knew nothing about it. So first question I had was can you even get the standard? Can you even get the standard model? And then after you ask, can you get the spectrum of the standard model, you can start doing more finely tuned things. We'll talk about this later. Can you add dimensional scales to it? Can you get low scale supersymmetry breaking? If so, you know, what are there any kinds of schemes for mediation that seem preferred or easy to get or hard to get and so on? This is the level that we're at the moment. I mean, eventually, of course, we're also trying to think about compact examples of this, compact manifolds that have 4 cycles with all these funny intersection numbers.
But another question to ask is, even if you don't manage to construct the model, it doesn't exist in another way you didn't thought of.
Yeah, that's sure.
We know how to do perturbation theory.
Mm-hmm.
If you have some realization like that, may help you to do some non-perturbative calculation, would it?
Oh, you're wondering why we're in a non-perturbative formulation, why we're in F2. This is crazy.
No, all of these brands are program.
Yeah.
So completely perturbative when you do this. I guess I think what is the basic aim?
I think of what you said.
Okay, just to restrict the number of effective things that you can construct.
I think it's what you said. It's to come with the philosophy of, if we, you know, if the MSSM is sitting in string theory, there are nice duality frames in type 2 where, you know, the particle physics regime is just describing local geometry. So can we try to build a model locally so that, you know, we can avoid having to, you know, avoid these problems of, you know, the huge string landscape? Can we just try to build from the bottom up and see what's possible, even from that point of view? And the question is, you know, this is lore that, like, you can do anything in string theory. I really think it's wrong. So. And you can see this already at local. Okay, so now we'll move on to generating scales and so on. So that's the end of the review of City Guts. Actually, I should ask you a bit more questions at this point. Okay, so any supersymmetric gut model requires a bunch of new dimensional parameters. We've talked about how to get the right matter content and how to get the right Yukawa couplings in the sense that Yukawa couplings you want are actually present. It's not saying that they're correct or anything, but they're present in progress. But any one of these guys needs a bunch of new scales. You need scale associated with supersymmetry breaking. And some work was done on actually supersymmetry breaking. I assess supersymmetry breaking in this theory of gut models here. The various parameters that you need for supersymmetry breaking, well, you need some soft masses, Dratino mass, and so on. And in a simple gauge mediated model, you'll have some spurion field X, has some bosonic expectation value that maybe sets the messenger mass, and some F component expectation value. But these things, they need to be small, relatively speaking. You know, you need this F over MS, MS, which is setting soft parameters, you want to be around 10 to the 3 GeV for low scale Suzy breaking. And for gravity mediation, this thing has to be less than on the order of 10 GeV. So the point is, these are scales which are not already there in the problem. The problem, we have the gut scale and the Plumb scale, is basically it. These scales are much, much, much smaller, and so we need to find some way to independently generate them. Another important scale is the mu parameter, supersymmetric Higgs mass. This enters into electron weak symmetry breaking. We need mu to be on the order of 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 3 GeV. So that's another small scale. Nice coincidence that this needs to be around the same order as these guys, but whatever. We also need mass scale for neutrino sector. You know, unlike when I first started physics, I remember with all the excitement with neutrino oscillations and so on. But now everybody knows that neutrinos are massive. And so you need to add some mass scale for neutrino sector, for example, maybe through right-handed neutrino masses. But just one number you can pop out of, look up in the literature, for example. Maybe you need like 10 to the 12 GeV. I mean, it depends on the neutrino sector, I think. But this is, you know, just one ballpark number. And the important thing is it's not the gut scale, something smaller. So you need some way to, first of all, incorporate all of these parameters into the model, because we haven't seen how to do that, and also figure out how to generate all these independent scales. You know, can we even do any of this? So all the necessary scales can be introduced at these SU7 points. And this was actually already noticed in the various ways in the papers of the Beasley-Heckman and Boffa effect. And that's nice, because these SU7 points are just pairs of intersecting these seven brains. Remember, it was just, they're described just by this picture of, you know, you have a, drawing this very quickly, I'll probably draw it badly. But you have the gut stack, which is here, and then you have two matter brains here and here. So this is a configuration that's really just two intersecting D7 brains, which then intersect the D7 brains, the gut stack. So it's a setup that, while you know the whole setup is not something that we can understand a perturbative type 2B, this thing is. So this engineers a coupling between the gut fields and the singlet of the form 5-5-1, and you can imagine, well, let's suppose I have 2-5 matter curves, which are not associated with any MSSM matter. They're not associated with Higgs's or anything. They're just completely new, and they intersect at a point x. Well, I get two new fields, f and f bar, and a superpotential like this. But this is precisely the superpotential of ordinary, you know, just plain old vanilla ordinary gauge mediation. So if we can manipulate the singlet field x to pick up an f component expectation value, then we've introduced gauge-mediated supersymmetry break. The second thing one can do is suppose we have these Higgs matter curves, and suppose they intersect at a point. Well, if they intersect at a point, there'll be a singlet field here localized, new one called y, and a superpotential yhh bar. And if we can manipulate the singlet to pick up a bosonic expectation value, then we've successfully engineered a mu term. The third possibility is, let's suppose we have a Higgs field meeting a 5-bar matter field. In this case, and there's a new singlet z, in this case, this z is appearing precisely where you expect right-handed neutrinos, yes, the right-handed neutrinos to appear. So if we can find some way to engineer a mass term for the singlet field, then we can incorporate it right into neutrino mass, hence a mass in the neutrino sector. So this problem of incorporating Suzy breaking, U parameter, neutrino masses, all of this can be boiled down to manipulating singlet fields that live at the intersection of two D7 brains. Totally simple system. Okay. Pardon? These singlet fields, these are, you would say, open string moduli, but we'll talk, yeah. Good. So, well, how do people generate small scales all the time? Well, in phenomenology, they use strongly coupled gauge groups and dimensional transmutation. String theory, we know that stringy instantons are able to capture these effects and even provide some new ones. So it's natural to look towards stringy instantons. So, yeah, so as I said, it's efficient to study a pair of intersecting seven brains and the charge field localized at the intersection. And to generate small scales, a natural mechanism to consider is D3 instantons, which, you know, may enter into the setup. We choose D3 instantons because they're sort of well-defined in F theory. If you take one of these guys and move around some singularity, they're well-defined objects. So, but to determine if any given instanton can generate two potential couplings, it's necessary to study the structure of zero modes that are present. So, quick review of this. A generic D3 instanton is going to have four universal Fermi zero modes. And the reason for this is that it's sitting in a background which preserves 8 supercharges. It breaks 4 of them, and so there's 4 Goldsteinos, and there they are. Now, if the D3 is not wrapping a rigid cycle, then there can be more. We'll always assume that it's wrapping a rigid cycle. In fact, we'll use Del-Petzl's because we can calculate with them, and they're nice. But so in general, a D3 instanton with these 4 universal zero modes is going to contribute some integral over all of them. But that doesn't look good. It doesn't look like superpotential coupling. So this is a very naive level. If these extra two of these guys said the mu's, two of them are lifted, or if their integration is saturated, then the instanton can contribute something that looks like a superpotential coupling. It's an integral over 2 fermionic forms. And indeed, we'll see that these are identified with supersymmetries that are preserved by 7 brain. So how does one take care of these extra modes? Well, I said a D3 in isolation has 4 universal zero modes, but if you have a D3 brain that's sitting on top of a D7 brain, it should see both the background and the 7 brain. The background preserves 8 supercharges, but the 7 brain preserves 4. So that means the net background plus 7 brain only preserves 4 supercharges. So the when the D3 is sitting on top of the 7 brain, if it knows about the 7 brain, it's breaking 4 supercharges down to 2, leaving us with 2 Goldsteinos. Now, when do we say that a D3 knows about a 7 brain? Well, when a D3 is sitting on top of a 7 brain, wrapping the same cycle, it can form a bound state. So that's certainly a case in which we know that it knows about the 7 brain. Now, you can actually see how the integration over these extra 0 modes gets saturated by just studying the 0 modes between the 7 brain and the 3 brain. I won't go over this, but basically, Bs are bosons and Fs are fermions. There's a coupling of these extra 0 modes to some bosonic and fermionic 0 modes that go between the 3 and the 7 brain. And this is just right to saturate the integration over these extra 0 modes. A thing to notice is that these are bosonic 0 modes. So if we were not integrating over them, if we imagine just giving them some non-zero expectation value, these mu's would pair up with the f with these these mu's would pair up with f and f bar and lift and become massive. And that's precisely the formation of the D3, D7 bound state. So the same term that's responsible for this D3, D7 bound state, lifting the extra Fermi zero modes, can actually saturate the integration of these extra zero modes. Good. And this is really well-known stuff. I hope there's so many papers on this, but I think those are the ones I was going to say. OK. So now we would contend that you should also sum over U1 flux configurations on the world volume of the D3 instanton. And this can be a little bit troublesome because these extra zero modes that we had that appear in this coupling actually get lifted when you turn on these fluxes. So you can ask, when those guys get lifted, what one of the effects that it does is it actually lifts the D3, D7 bound, it lifts the Higgs branch and removes the honest D3, D7 bound state. But the D3 can still wrap the same cycle as the D7. So it can still form a marginal bound state at threshold. And you can ask if this is enough to take care of these extra zero modes. And we claim the answer is yes. And we claim you can see it operationally, at least, by noting that mu still couples to those same 3-7 modes. They're massive now, but who cares? They're still there. It still couples to them. And so you can still saturate this mu integration and get a non-zero result for this D2 theta. So that's one sort of technical point. Yes, please.
Yeah,
I think you can say
and what does it mean that D3 brain wraps the cycle?
Oh, sorry. The D7 brain is, so this is a picture of right. The D7 brain is wrapping some 4 cycle on the geometry. And we're just saying the D3 brain is wrapping the same, or D3 instanton is wrapping the same 4 cycle on the geometry.
Right. In fact,
if we had n D7 brains, I would say this is just capturing, well, in this last slide, this thing is just capturing, if we had n D7 brains, just capturing usual gauge instanton contributions to superpotentials. This is something a little new, right? I'm not totally 100% certain of its interpretation, but it seems to be inherently stringy. The other thing about it is that these D3 instantons also contribute when you only have one D7 brain. I think Shaman is going to call it stringy instantons.
So you've looked at a particular set of, or I'm not sure where we're going, but
yeah. You're
looking at a particular set of D3 instantons.
Right.
Are you going to count all of them?
Good. In principle, you should count all of them. And you should count all of them and all of them that are supersymmetric and can contribute. The point is, this issue of these extra zero modes has the effect of removing most of them. So usually it's more a problem, my understanding is it's less a problem of overabundance than more a problem of getting anything at all. So this is one mechanism where you consider D3s that wrap the same cycle as the D7s, where these zero modes go away. You can have, the only other way I can see immediately that the D3 instanton could make some contribution to the physics for X would be if it wraps, say, the 2-cycle X is wrapping something else. Or maybe it wraps a 4-cycle that meets this point, and I don't know, maybe that could do something. But in such a case, you would have to understand, invoke some mechanism for lifting these extra zero modes. So it's possible there are other instanton contributions that are going on away from what we're talking about, that's for sure. But it's not like they're guaranteed to be there. Usually you have to do some work in order to get them to be there. But as usual with this local model building stuff, it's, you know, there's assumptions of, you know, built in. Does that answer your question?
I guess so. But I guess in the framework, I mean, if I set myself or my student the challenge of counting all of the D3 instantons, would it be possible given the information that, you know?
In this local context, the only ones I'm aware of that can contribute without adding something extra are the ones we're talking about. It's my understanding. Yeah, basically because we're describing so little of the geometry, the only four cycles we're even specifying are the ones that the gut brains are wrapping and the ones that these matter brains are wrapping. And we're not specifying any other four cycles, so these are really all of the candidates.
And you briefly mentioned the possibility of a D1 instanton by talking about two cycles. And
oh, no, I didn't mention, I didn't, sorry, I didn't
well,
mean to say D1 instanton.
I think you almost said that.
Oh, no, I didn't want to say that.
are you going to mention them later?
No. So I'm actually not sure. So part of the reason we studied D3 instantons is they're the only non-perturbative contributions we're aware of, largely because it comes from the classification of instanton contributions in M theory, you know, following the M theory dualities. It's basically some class of M5 instantons. These guys carry over here. D1 instantons, I wouldn't know what to make of them because they're not really well defined in this background.
So that intersection isn't well defined. I mean, aren't there two special two cycles?
There are special two cycles, but I don't. Okay, I'm talking now about things I don't understand so well, but the reason I say D1 is yes.
Which percentage will be broken?
Pardon?
Which percentage will be broken?
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, there will be, yes, that's for sure. Thank you.
I had a question. So the D3 instantons, they don't break supersymmetry.
No. We choose. No. The D3 instanton, the trivial flux doesn't break supersymmetry, and we sum over all flux set configurations which are supersymmetric. And now you will ask me how do I determine which ones are supersymmetric? And then I will tell you that we have that which one is supersymmetric depends on the Cator form. And the Cator form is one of these guys that has some coupling constants in it.
Sorry, this is
easy,
but why
would
we care about the D1
instanton? Yeah, Joe may actually remind me for him. They're not supersymmetric.
And so?
Too many zero modes.
So one can ask, once we've decided that these things can actually contribute, what kind of couplings are generated? And this comes from understanding the spectrum of 3-7 modes flying around. So there are 3-7 modes which connect the D7 brain to the D3 instanton, which connect the D3 instanton to the second D7 branch. Remember, we're studying 2 and 6 D7 brains. And then which connect the D7 to the D7 prime. And these things generically appear in instanton action couplings like this, alpha beta x, the agent brain combination, circle. And when you integrate over these alpha and beta Fermi zero modes, you bring down power of x. And so if you want to generate some polynomial superpotential like x to the n, then, well, for starters, you really need this n alpha is equal to n beta. You need the numbers of these zero modes to be the same as the numbers of these zero modes. So it's a simple problem to figure out when you can generate kinds of superpotential couplings. Now, when trying to build compact models, it's nice to have an idea for what geometric features you need from one of these intersections in order to get a given kind of superpotential. If you want to engineer, say, a superpotential for Suzy braking, you'd like to know, well, what kinds of, you know, topological conditions do we need to aim for in order for this to even be possible? And this is a question you can answer, at least in the nice case of Delpetzos, because we know a lot about Delpetzos. So if you want to generate a given superpotential like this, and remember we need this condition, it's actually very easy to study these conditions if we make two assumptions. One, the D3 instanton wraps a Delpetzos surface, and I'll just tell you, we like Delpetzos because it's easy to calculate. And we make an assumption of the Cator form of the Delpetzos would be a large volume type. So remember, the Delpetzos is a P2 that's blown up with some number of points. So this H is the hyperplane class, comes from the P2, these E's, the exceptional divisors associated with the walls of points. And just assume that this A is much larger than B, so you have a big P2 with some little points on it.
This is not such an important constraint. It just removes some annoying extra possibilities for us. So if we forget about the extra possibilities that this gets rid of for us, it's possible this n alpha equals to m, which is a statement about the number of zero modes from the seventh grade to the D3 instanton. It doesn't know about this intersection surface sigma. It just knows because it's from the two guys wrapping the same cycle. You can actually list all instanton configurations to satisfy this. It's a very small list. It's basically things like this up to permutation. So you can already see there's a list of possibilities. And then you can look through this list and say, are any of them supersymmetric? If they're supersymmetric, they contribute. If they're not supersymmetric, they don't. But it's nice that the list is about, you know, is something very short. If you further impose this n beta equals to m condition, then that's a statement about zero modes connecting things on the two different four cycles. So that's going to involve sigma. And that condition amounts basically just to a condition on the restriction of these bundles to sigma. So the nice thing about this is it's a very short list. So this condition on restricting a, you know, bundle from this list having some, you know, being like m minus m minus 1 actually translates into a condition on the homology class of sigma. So you can actually put together a dictionary of what kind of homology classes for sigma viewed as a homology class in this domain. What kind of homology classes for sigma allow for very superpotentials? For example, if you want a linear superpotential, I think that sigma was sort of h minus e1 minus e2, something like this. I maybe remember it wrong because the right thing is not here, but I think this is right. And so on. And really, if you try to get any other cycle from this, it's just, you know, it's not possible to consistently, you know, have this kind of restriction. So it's a very simple set of restrictions, and so this determines what kinds of superpotentials are possible. But given the ability to generate polynomial superpotentials, you can in principle break supersymmetry by engineering a Bologna superpotential. You can give expectation value to fields by, you know, doing some funny thing I won't get into because it won't be so important. Or you can generate mass terms for fields. So by generating polynomial superpotentials, you can manipulate these cyclic fields that we were talking about before, and also using the instantons generate naturally exponentially suppressed scales, although the degree of exponential suppression is something that depends on moduli stabilization, as you'll point out.
Sorry.
Yes, please.
So all the discussion up to now was based on the fact that we want to restrict whatever contributes based on supersymmetry, right? However, you are saying that intrinsically in this model, the supersymmetry is spontaneously broke.
What's mean, yeah.
So wouldn't you have to now go back and reanalyze? Well, actually, I don't even know how to pose this question in a computational way, but say, how would you know that after, so you know that in your model supersymmetry is broken, so for example, V1 instantons that we were talking about in principle could contribute. How do we know that their contribution would not be essential or any other terms that you throw away based on the fact that it was not supersymmetric? But we don't have supersymmetry anyway.
That's right, we don't have supersymmetry, but we have supersymmetry at the cascade. What we're producing with this is an effective theory at the cascade, which is intrinsically supersymmetric. Supersymmetry is well, depending on the definition of an interval, is broken at low scale relative to that. So that's what I would say. What we're specifying is basically an effective action at the cut scale, and that's fully supersymmetric.
Good.
So there's one little.
Hello.
Yes, please.
Can I just ask colleagues a really simple question? I mean, so just like, suppose I have, say, a too many zero mode, can I just try to separate them by say inserting some operators from the zero mode to fermion just to get some non-specific tidal coupling.
I should have stated this before. There are lots of fairly detailed studies of how you can lift these extra zero modes, which include turning up all fluxes and things like this. But in the case of here's a really just the notebook where it comes in on, so not something I'm aware of without actually introducing something that's very supersymmetric.
Okay.
Okay. So there's one annoying technical subtlety, and that comes from the fact that we eventually have to couple this to a gut. So we take our intersecting D7 brains and we throw in the gut stack of D7 brains. In doing this, the D3 instanton, because it's wrapping one of the same cycles as one of these D7 brains, this D3 instanton also intersects the gut stack along a matter curve. And so there's the annoying possibility that there are extra Fermi zero modes connected to the D3 instanton in the gut stack. And these extra zero loads can spoil all the superconductors we were talking about before. They could either not be saturated, or in bringing powers of them down, you generate not polynomial couplings in X, but you start bringing down fields that are charged under the MSSM. And generically, in that way, it would, in fact, get couplings that violate hypercharge and nasty things like this. So a necessary condition to get rid of all of these three gut zero loads is that both the instanton bundle and the hypercharge bundle restrict trivially to the matter. However, we use hypercharge to lift the Higgs triplets. You know, precisely the reason that this constraint comes about is because these three gut zero modes come in gut multiplets, but when you turn on hypercharge gauge bundle, these gut multiplets split. And you want to count all of them, you know, if you want to kill all of them, that's a large number of conditions, you can't satisfy all of them if you're distinguishing among them. Well, this hypercharge distinguishes among them, while if hypercharge bundle is trivial, it doesn't. If hypercharge bundle is trivial, doesn't distinguish among them, one condition you can satisfy it. But if it starts distinguishing among them, then you have too many conditions to satisfy, then you have degrees of freedom actually to play with. And so it turns out you actually cannot lift the Higgs triplets. It's a very, basically, you need the degree of this bundle to be service true. So in order to lift these three gut zero modes, this LY needs to restrict trivially, but it does not restrict trivially to Higgs matter curves. So that means that in a certain sense, we cannot use these three instantons to graph Higgs matter frames. Now, use is a very funny word. I mean, as you're pointing out, you have no choice. If these three instantons are there or not, you can't just use them. But we're thinking from an operational point of view where you want these three instantons to be present and then you engineer the geometry, the Cantor form, so they do contribute. But in all cases, but if you take adopt this point of view, you better make sure that these three instantons wrapping these Higgs matter frames are not giving contributions because they will mess you up. So this means that we can generate Susie breaking. Because we can rank these three instantons wrapping this matter brain and this matter brain can in principle do it if we set things up correctly. We can generate neutrino masses because instantons wrapping this matter brain could in principle do it, again if we set things up properly. But a mu parameter is not, it doesn't look like we can do it because we can't really use, you know, these three instantons wrapping this matter brain and this matter brain have this problem with extra zero loads. Now there is an alternate possibility where you have a double instanton which is wrapping all of these things, and in that case it might be possible to make something work that requires even more tuning. Good. So, I'm getting mu. We saw here that supersymmetry breaking neutrino masses in principle can come from the stuff, but mu cannot. So we take this as evidence that mu is a derived scale in these models. It's not being independently generated. But this is kind of natural for phenomenology. I'll try to wrap up soon. This is kind of natural for phenomenology because electroweak symmetry breaking already says that mu should be the same order as, you know, soft peak masses. Let's suppose to take as input that mu is related to the Susie breaking sector and ask how can we generate it. Well, the simplest thing you can do is just couple the Susie breaking and Higgs sectors together. And there's basically two ways to do that in these kinds of models. So two simple, you just follow your nose, the most nice, silly thing possible. Just intersect the sectors. You can either intersect them at SU12 points or at SU7 points. If you do it this way, then you get your single fields here and here that you have to, play with. If you do it this way, you have some new 10 field. And sort of the simplest thing you can imagine is having the same 10 coming up and hitting both of these guys. It doesn't have to be that. It can be two different things. But I like this model because all the reasons I'll talk about in a minute. We're not going to spend so much time on this because these extra singlets mean more instantons and more of this kind of stuff, more arbitrariness, and we don't want to get into that. So we'll talk about this framework. So first thing we want to do is we don't want this 10 curve that we're forced to introduce to couple these guys together to have any extra zero modes. So we pick bundles so there's no zero modes on. So then you can ask, in this kind of construction, what is the effective action below the gut scale look like? That's really all we can say at the moment because, we're limited to symmetry. Well, the geometry provides you a number of symmetries. As I was saying before, each one of these brains has a U1 on it. It's not as simple as they all have independent U1s. Things get sort of tied up together at these triple intersection points. But you can carefully analyze the geometry to figure out what U1 symmetries you have, or you can read them off directly from the superposition. So that's what I did here just because it's easier. Here's the Sewell potential, and you can read off all these U1 charges. And these U1 symmetries are going to, even though their corresponding gauge bosons become massive, they'll enter as approximate global symmetries of the effective theory called the gut scale. And I'll focus on this one in particular. This one in particular is really nice. This U1 PQ, the Higgs and Higgs bar have the same charge under it. So it forbids a bare mu term, which, and this is often a tool invoked to explain why mu is much smaller than the Planck scale, for example. But this X field also comes out with a non-zero charge with respect to this U1 PQ. So This means when x picks up an expectation value that breaks this U1PQ, that expectation or breaks supersymmetry, it also breaks U1PQ. And so this connects the breaking of supersymmetry with the generation of mu, and in particular gives a nice explanation, roughly speaking, for why the same kind of exponential suppression is happening in Hall. This is not a new idea by any means. I first learned about it from these authors, but I'd be really surprised if it was not something that was around before that, but I don't know the literature about it. So this U1PQ constraints the effective action below M dot to be of this kind of generic form, and you'll see that this, I'll just go to the next page. This first guy, if x picks up an F component expectation value, this first guy gives you a mu parameter, and the second guy gives you a soft Higgs parameter. And the important thing is this Fx here, which is this exponentially suppressed guy that's generated by instantons, is the same suppression that appeared in supersymmetry. Another cute thing to notice is the term that could have generated B mu. This thing is forbidden by the PQ symmetry, so B mu is actually equal to zero with the messenger scale in these models. And this is known to provide a nice solution to the new B mu problem, which I won't say anymore. Okay, so then I'll just close by making a few comments about the Suzy breaking sector. I'll try to hurry. So we were breaking supersymmetry with a Polonyi superpotential, which looks like this. Of course, Polonyi models have a pseudo-moduli space of supersymmetry breaking vacuum, which are lifted by corrections to the Cayley potential, which come in from high-scale physics. There are two immediate possible sources for such corrections. One source are just KK modes that enter into the gut scale. And we entered this project sort of aiming for one particular class of models. So when we saw it, we were very happy, and we said, aha, we'll just assume the new physics is coming from KK scale and be done with it. So this lands on a sort of kind of framework that's already been around in the phenomenological literature. The other possibility is you have this massive PQ gauge boson could be lighter than the gut scale. And integrating that out could generate these higher scale, higher quartic corrections and so on. And that's a fairly predictive framework because you know, relatively speaking, how all the fields couple to it because it's fixed by the PQ charges. That's a novel scenario whose phenomenology has recently been discussed by Jonathan Fleming. So in all that follows in the rest of this, I'll be talking about this parameter regime because this is what we were talking about. Their paper works out some very nice phenomenology for the other possibilities. So this is a nice example of a local model in string theory giving you a previously studied model and also a new model. So one expects these Kaluza Klein modes to correct the Cayley potential, will give support to correction of the gut scale. And depending on the sign of A, you'll either get expectation value of x around 0 or expectation value of x around the gut scale. Both of these are kind of bad. X at m gut is too large for gauge deviation, and you're already outside of the regime of validity of this expansion anyway, so that's bad. X equals 0 is bad because it leads to vanishing messenger masses. So something has to be done to move x to non-zero values. One possibility is to introduce an Fi parameter. Another possibility is this thing called gravitational gauge mediation, which was talked about by Reichert and Pitano, where he notes that in general, nothing prevents supergravity from generating a linear term capable of shifting the minimum of x. This is the gauge invariant. Sorry, this should be Fx. So this is the instanton generated guy. This is gauge invariant, remembering that this thing contains an axion that shifts under the U1 gauge symmetry. So it's nice and gauge invariant. And you can't just throw it away, assuming it's Planck suppressed, because it's the leading contribution to this linear term. So it's gravity generating a term that was absent before. Indeed, you can see how such a term might arise. If you have a flux contribution to W from maybe something away from the gut stack, you can model that by adding a constant to the superpotential. And if you do that, well, this constant, of course, has no effect in the strict decoupling limit, m plus infinity, but at finite and large m plus, you get a potential that looks like this. And this linear term is very important and leads to a non-zero expectation value of x, which looks like this. And if you further assume that W naught is of roughly, that this thing is of roughly order one, you get something that's around 10 to the 14 CV. But, you know, anyway, you get something that's non-zero. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about that. So basically, the summary is on this thing. This model, by the way, named sweet spot supersymmetry. It has some problems with it. But it's some nice framework that seems to come out from F-theory. It's dictated by the symmetries that come out from F-theory. The important points I want to make are that the structure is fixed by the PQ symmetry with an X is true, under which X carries the charge. D3 instantons from the string construction generated simultaneously a superpotential that breaks Suzy and UMPQ. So there's a small scale in this effective action, but from the string construction, it's totally natural. And you can get this kind of framework from an explicit X to 5 gut type constructions in string theory. So let me just skip to the end. So I'll just conclude now by saying that local models are a nice way to make connection with particle physics, and that if you know, that it's possible in these F-theory gut models to do a lot of nice things. You can generate small scales naturally, you can generate gauge mediation, and F theory really likes to produce these extra symmetries for you, like this UFTQ, that do nice things like explain why you respond. So I've gone a little bit over all this stuff. Thanks a lot.
Okay, even though we've run over, are there any more questions for Joe?
So this is really a basic question. So I guess I just want to ask that, suppose I have some non-square symmetry for the Euclidean, say, non-square symmetry for the Euclidean, a deeper Hilbert somehow. Suppose I have those configurations. But doesn't mean that I automatically break supersymmetry problem, or does that mean that they don't contribute at all?
No, I think the things I would feel safe saying, maybe you can correct me. Things I would feel safe saying is that they don't contribute, or they don't contribute to a potential problem. Or they either don't contribute, or they don't contribute to potential problems. That's what I would feel safe saying.
You always say they don't contribute to this one.
They
don't contribute to precipitation.
Yeah, that's the same that I feel comfortable with.
But they may break some symmetry by themselves. Or they actually don't contribute to the total physics.
I don't think they break supersymmetry by themselves.
They don't. No, so you would say they don't contribute to this one, or they don't contribute to the Taylor potential, or? I mean, so really, I'm not trying to defend it here. I'm just trying to ask if they break symmetry or not.
No, I don't think they do. No.
Unless they do, they could be very interesting.
No, I don't think they do. Why? I don't think they do, because, I mean, well, I haven't thought about it, but I would say, I mean, the extra zero modes basically will come in and kill you.
I can't settle them by inserting some.
But whatever you insert is going to have to. Are you inserting things that further break supersymmetry on their own?
That's right. Just
so. Well, then you've broken supersymmetry already.
Right. So it's just like to generate some non-supersymmetric coupling.
When you have a background, and then you're going to put that, and then there's going to be some incidental contribution to the background.
Right. Which
if you add something which lifts these extra zero modes that breaks supersymmetry in the background, and say you already broke supersymmetry by hand.
Exactly. So that's what I say. If I allow those configurations, it seems there will be automatically some non-supersymmetric coupling being generated by them.
Okay.
That's why.
But you've broken supersymmetry by hand already.
Why do you call that break by hand? I mean, see, suppose I have those configurations.
Sorry? They're either there or they're not there.
No, I don't think they're there. What we're talking about is what you must do to lift the extra zero modes that are present at the non-supersymmetry. And I would contend that you'd have to do something with base supersymmetry already to do it. If you have a supersymmetric background, I don't think you're there. I haven't thought so much.
I really just asked. I just think it would be quite interesting to understand that even in the absence of this more realistic model, just take it for example, and see if it actually happens better.
Yeah, I don't think people would study so much perspective or non perspective.
Oh, thanks.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Joe.